From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. President Trump visits Kenosha, Wisconsin today, 9 days after a white police officer there shot Jacob Blake, a black man, in the back, paralyzing him from the waist down. Protesters took to the streets, and over the weekend, armed civilians showed up. One of them, 17-year-old Kyle Rittenhouse, has been charged with homicide in the shooting death of two people and the serious injury of another. Now, last night, President Trump condemned the shooting death of a far-right militia member during separate protests in Oregon, but then came to the defense of Rittenhouse, who is seen on tape running toward protesters with his gun, shooting one before tripping, and again is charged with killing two. His lawyers say he was defending himself. The president seemed to agree.
We're looking at all of it. That was an interesting situation. You saw the same tape as I saw. And he was trying to get away from them, I guess, it looks like. And he fell. And then they very violently attacked him. And it was something that we're looking at right now, and it's under investigation.
So what happens when a president defends an accused shooter? Let's bring in Jeffrey Toobin on Skype. He's a legal analyst for CNN and The New Yorker, also author of the new book, High Crimes and Misdemeanors, The Investigation of Donald Trump. Jeffrey, the president making statements about this shooting, there's an ongoing investigation, likely to be a trial. Any legal questions about, you know, maybe the president having influence on the outcome here?
Well, he is an American with First Amendment rights, and he can express any opinion he likes about a pending legal matter. As a prudential matter, as a traditional matter, as a matter of norms and customs, presidents have not expressed opinions about pending legal matters, especially criminal cases. This is a norm that the president has violated, like so many norms he has violated. But I want to be clear, it's not illegal for the president to express an opinion like this.
Well, but some people might be remembering when then President Obama reflected on Trayvon Martin, who was a shooting victim in Florida, saying that he could have been his own son. This was before there was, you know, any, you know, trial or consideration there.
Right. I mean, it's a very different situation. I think the closer analogy, it goes back much farther, is the Manson case, the Charles Manson case in Los Angeles, that during the trial, then President Richard Nixon expressed the view that Manson was guilty, and Manson held up a copy of the newspaper for the jury, and it caused a sensation, and it was widely considered inappropriate. Again, it wasn't illegal. They're just something that presidents generally think it's better not to do.
The president has also called Black Lives Matter a symbol of hate. He's exaggerated the violence on the streets. There have been mostly peaceful protests, although no question violence. Again, supported somebody who came with a long gun to a peaceful protest. Can the president be held responsible for ginning up armed civilians and sending them into protests on his behalf?
I don't see any way he could be held legally responsible. You know, the legal rules of causation are pretty strict. So I don't think he could be sued for damages in connection with any of these elements. But he could be held responsible by the voters. He's about to come up for re-election. And this is obviously something that has turned into a major flashpoint. And the voters can make their judgment in part on this issue. But I don't think there is a technical legal problem for the president, given what he said.
And by the way, Vice President Biden, in his speech yesterday, condemned violence on all sides. You know, some will, I'm sure, question why we're even talking about this, because they feel that when President Trump makes statements like supporting a 17-year-old who, you know, even on video, you can see, has taken his long gun into a group of protesters, that's just a distraction, this is exactly what he wants us to do, instead of focusing on the shooting of a black man, Jacob Blake. Put on your political hat. I mean, it's hard to understand why he's made these statements. Do you have, you know, any thinking on that?
Well, I don't think it's hard to understand why he's made these statements. I think he feels like the forces of white backlash will help him get reelected. I don't have any problem covering the statements. I mean, I understand what we do has political implications, But I am perfectly comfortable with the idea that we cover statements by the president, especially when they're outrageous.
Jeffrey Toobin, legal analyst for CNN and The New Yorker, thank you.
Thank you.
Hundreds of thousands of people who live in Louisiana are still without power after Hurricane Laura. The backbone of the state's power grid suffered catastrophic damage. And Governor John Bel Edwards says some areas are so damaged, the power grid will need to be rebuilt from the ground up. At a news conference yesterday, the governor also warned of the dangers of trying to restore power and other services during the record-breaking heat.
Without there being adequate water service in some areas, certainly not the air conditioning and so forth, it is imperative that people take frequent breaks and make sure that they don't get overheated.
The governor also said power in the northern and central parts of the state could be restored in a few days, but for residents in southwestern Louisiana, it could take longer. Lulu Henderson is a resident of Lake Charles, and she and her husband live in a mobile home community there, and she joins us now. Welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you so much.
How are you and your family right now?
We're doing good. I know I'm still in shock a little bit about everything that's been going on the past few days.
I can imagine. I mean, you moved to Louisiana from Dallas, Texas, about a year ago. This is the first hurricane you've ever experienced, and I understand that you and your family were intending to ride out the storm in your mobile home, but decided to go to a hotel once the hurricane got stronger. That had to be terrifying.
As it got closer to the time of the storm, it went from a voluntary evacuation to a mandatory evacuation. So that kind of, that was really scary.
Absolutely. What's the status of your mobile home right now? Have you been able to go back and retrieve some of what's left?
Well, it's hard getting into Lake Charles because most of the streets are not passable. There's nothing but landlines. We've seen semi-trucks being entangled. It's literally like one road to get in and out. The community next to us, most of their homes were destroyed. The community where we live in, all of the homes are off of their foundations, so they're not livable at this point. We can't really assess the real damage of it because we can't go inside of our home for fear that it's going to completely slide off of its foundation. But my husband was able to retrieve a few of our items so that we could go in there.
What was he able to get?
We were able to get a few more clothes, personal items like, pictures, some heirlooms, my dad's vinyl records. It's kind of hard when you have to leave the rest of your items in your home.
I'm sorry, Lulu.
It's hard to see that. You're thankful for your life and everything, but at the same time, it's hard to know that you're going to have to start all the way over.
Mm-hmm. Have you and your family been able to find a place to stay since the hurricane hit? I know you were at a hotel.
It's hard. We're so thankful for everybody that's coming into the city, but they pretty much booked up all the rooms for like all the different people who are coming in to try to get the city back stable again, because like I said, there's no power in Lake Charles anywhere. We had to drive 3 hours away from our home to find somewhere to stay.
Where are you staying?
We're staying in Marksville, Louisiana, with my in-laws. So that's a 3-hour drive back and forth. Before we even go into Lake Charles, we have to make sure that we have gas because there's no gas in Lake Charles. And then there's long lines.
Mm-hmm. There's also this oppressive heat and the possibility of a spike in coronavirus cases. What do you want people outside of Louisiana to know about what you and your neighbors are going through right now, your greatest need?
We need people to come and help. Like, it's a lot of elderly people who have trees in their yard. There's people coming in, but they're charging people to cut their trees. We need gas, work gloves, trash cans, trash bags, bug spray, because in the heat is like unbearable. So ice, you know, chest with water and ice in it, you know, gallons of water, bottled water, diapers for the kids. The Red Cross and everybody is giving those kind of things, but they're not giving you like gas.
Mm-hmm.
So you can't get around. So if people can bring those kind of things, or they're willing to come down and really volunteer their time, don't take advantage of a person's situation by charging them. Because a lot of us can't get access to our ATM and our bank account. And if you're going to come and volunteer out of the goodness and the kindness of your heart.
Lulu, I'm so sorry that you're dealing with this. And I really thank you for sharing your story and really this call for help.
And like I said, if anybody wants to come down and help, you will not be turned away with your help.
That's Lulu Henderson of Lake Charles, Louisiana. Again, thank you, and my best to you and your family. Please take care of yourselves.
Thank you so much for having me.
This week, several states have started to send out absentee ballots ahead of the election. And you've probably seen the photos of the USPS uprooting mailboxes or stories of mail sorting machines being turned off as part of cost-saving measures. But our next guest says those aren't the biggest concern she has for the Postal Service's ability to provide service leading up to and during the election. Jessica Hoosman is a reporter for ProPublica, and she covers voting rights and election administration and joins us now. Welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
Jessica, one of the biggest challenges right now to USPS are these cost-cutting changes under the Trump administration. You've been reporting on something specific, and that's overtime, which is basically built into the way USPS operates. How do these cuts to hours, as you've reported, impact overall service?
You know, this is really the thing that troubles me most about the changes that were made this year at the USPS. I think that, you know, people have been really focused on the sorting machines and the blue mailboxes that they see in pictures being removed. But I think behind the scenes, the actual changes that will impact voting are those policy changes like cutting overtime or cutting second trips on specific routes for mail delivery. And so, you know, I think that your listeners should think about the mail like a traffic jam. If it's backed up, it's going to continue to be backed up. Once the accident is cleared, that doesn't mean that traffic starts going at the rate it was going before. It has to clear. And so as the mail backs up and backs up and backs up, we're only going to see slower service. But I think that the changes that Mr. DeJoy said that he will now no longer make are very positive. It's just not clear as to how the backup has log jammed the USPS at this point.
Can you explain why the USPS relies on overtime in the first place? I mean, I think we all understand it's in part due to the pandemic, but I actually know quite a few postal workers, and it's kind of been built into their schedules for the last few years to have overtime. Can you explain that for us?
Right, exactly. And I think that that's really important to point out. You know, we have a certain understanding of overtime. They hire fewer postal workers because those postal workers can work additional hours. And so the USPS has long had a policy where if the letter arrives at the facility and it's due to be sent out that day, it gets sent out that day, regardless of how many shifts the letter carrier must do. Ending that policy is not just a cost-saving measure. It's a radical departure from the way that the USPS has always operated. And, you know, I think that it is only in the last decade or so that people have begun to really view the post office as a private company rather than a service provided by the federal government. And I think that we're seeing all of that in terms of the shift in tone really impacting the policy discussion that we're having now.
Well, there's a push from politicians to privatize as well.
Right.
I mean, I know that what you're saying there, but there's also this additional push to privatize. We are all focused on this upcoming presidential election. Is there anything that states can do
to try to make things run more smoothly in November. We talked with the head of the union who said there likely will be delays. They will still get the job done, but there could be delays.
Right. You know, I think that states can do a couple of things. What I think folks are not recognizing is that the delay and the inability for the USPS to get ballots to the Central Elections Office is not a new problem. And there are a lot of causes for the problem. And part of the cause is that states have unrealistic expectations of the USPS. For example, there are many states where you can request an absentee ballot be mailed to you less than 4 days before the election takes place. And if you consider that first class mail delivery takes between 2 and 5 business days to complete, then that's not enough time to even receive your ballot, much less cast it and send it back. And so these deadlines have been on the books for states for many years, and counties and states have been able to accommodate them because absentee ballots are generally not very frequently requested. But in a pandemic, many more folks are using the mail to transport their ballots. There are several states where bills to move that deadline back to make it more realistic for modern mail service are sitting on the desks of legislatures, but they will not pass them because they're afraid of being viewed as suppressing the vote. You know, you can see how that would play out in the media. If Ohio, for example, in which you can request an absentee ballot up to the Saturday before the Tuesday election, if they move that date back, the calls about voter suppression in Ohio would grow even stronger, even though by allowing that deadline to be as close to the election day as they are, they're likely suppressing even more votes. But the outcry is what they're afraid of. And so that needs to change. And then also, states need to have a better understanding of how the USPS functions in a really nuanced way, how the ballots are scanned, how the ballots are sorted, because a lot of the problem for delivery carriers is the way that ballot envelopes are designed. In places that do this really well, they've got these envelopes that are specifically designed to be read by the machinery that their local post office uses so that they can make sure that they're sorted and timestamped appropriately. They're also color-coded so that the color of the envelope that goes to voters is different from the color of the envelope that comes back to the election office. So that way, if a postal carrier is carrying a letter to a location, but they know that it's the wrong color, then the postal carrier themselves can troubleshoot that problem and fix it. This is a logistics management issue, and it's not one that a lot of counties have dealt with in depth. And now they're all having to sort of speed read their way through compliance procedures and ballot design and envelope design. But it is going to have to be a lot of teamwork between the local postmasters and the local election administrators to make sure that the load can be accommodated and the envelopes are appropriately designed.
That's Jessica Hoosman. She is a reporter at ProPublica. She covers voting rights and election administration. Thank you so much for joining us.
Not a problem at all. Thanks so much.
Well, it's day two for a very different U.S. Open tennis tournament. There are no fans at the matches in Flushing Meadows, New York, and some of the world's top players opted out because of the pandemic. But there is top flight tennis. Top seed Novak Djokovic and 2018 U.S. Open champ Naomi Osaka were among the winners on day one yesterday. Pam Shriver, the ESPN analyst and former U.S. Open singles finalist, is here. Pam, the New York Times described this as decidedly bizarre. What are you seeing?
Well, yeah, I mean, I'm actually home in Los Angeles with quite the setup in my office so that I can cover remotely and do what I can. I've got three high schoolers home. One of my children's has at-risk underlying conditions for the virus, so I just couldn't take the risk to travel. And I totally understand why athletes like Rafa Nadal and Ash Barty on the women's side, you know, decided they didn't want to make the trip. However, I think what the USTA has done is to create the best bubble they possibly could with all the information, all the data, all the medicine, medical information, and I think the players that are there feel really quite safe.
Yeah. Well, we can't help but think of current events. These matches follow the Cincinnati, which they held on the same court so players wouldn't have to travel. Novak Djokovic won, but he seemed, you know, somewhat chastened then. You know, he's the one who had the party early on in the pandemic. Players got sick. I mean, it doesn't seem to be affecting his play. Obviously, he did great yesterday, but it's in the air.
Well, I think everybody has unease. Novak's dealing with not only what happened a couple of months ago, the tournament he put on where quite a few players, including himself, tested positive and they didn't practice what we know you have to practice to keep yourself safe. But he's also trying to start a new men's players association. So he's got tennis politics. He's got the virus. He's trying to win his, I think it would be his 19th major title. So there's a lot on his plate. There's a lot on everybody's plate, including Serena Williams, who plays today on ESPN as she goes after her record-tying 24th major, with everything on her plate being a wife and the mom to an almost three-year-old. So anyway, actually, maybe it's even today is Olympia's birthday. So everybody's dealing with a lot.
I know, you know, and by the way, not everyone's happy with Djokovic's plan, but you're speaking of the women now, and there's 16-year-old Coco Gauff, who, you know, got so much buzz when she won her first two matches of the Open last year. She's out of the U.S. Open, but, you know, she gave that incredible speech in June about the Black Lives Matter movement. You can't help but think that this might be affecting her and other players.
Yeah, I mean, there's enough to deal with when you're trying to just be the best tennis player. But I feel like the young tennis players who are of color are really stepping up to be great leaders. Coco Gauff, Naomi Osaka, she was the one who stepped forward first last week when the Cincinnati tournament ended up taking a pause alongside the NBA, WNBA, and other sports. So, you know, you're thrust into a leadership position. You either have what it takes or you don't. And in this case, these players do. And obviously in women's tennis, you have the greatest role model of them all in Billie Jean King and what she went through in the early 70s to push women's tennis into more equal footings alongside men's tennis. Therefore, we have a U.S. Open that's been played with equal prize money since 1973.
Yeah. By the way, the recent issue of Tennis Magazine lays out just how much tennis has been entwined with activism. It's terrific. But tennis is being played, and it's good tennis. ESPN analyst Pam Shriver, thanks for helping us bring attention to it. Thank you.
Thank you, Robin.
McDonald's faces a new racial discrimination lawsuit. 52 Black former franchisees accuse the company of pushing them into less profitable locations and treating them unfairly in internal reviews. The news comes after the fast food giant pledged to recruit more diverse franchisees, even as the number of Black operators has declined. Robin Farzad is host of Public Radio's Full Disclosure, and he joins us now. And Robin, the plaintiffs argue that McDonald's didn't give them the same opportunities that other franchisees got. How so?
Yeah, by the allegation is that McDonald's corporate steered Black franchisees toward poorer performing stores in more challenged neighborhoods, which, I mean, if you put income aside, they're already more costly to operate in these lower income neighborhoods because of their higher security expenses and insurance expenses. So the plaintiffs are pegging the kind of the opportunity cost, the missed opportunity, at about $4 to $5 million per location on average. So it's not just a rounding error.
Interesting. The National Black McDonald's Operators Association keeps track of the number of Black franchisees, and their data shows that it's declined over time. How has the company responded to these allegations?
Look, McDonald's is enormous. They're north of 14,000 stores in the U.S., and it's really had to, over the past decade, right-size its relationship with franchisees. I remember some were very upset when it did the whole breakfast all day thing. It's pretty much a love-hate relationship between the mothership in Illinois and the thousands and thousands of franchisees across the country. So the corporation here, I mean, they're insisting that the total number of owners declined because of franchisee attrition and consolidation, but that Black owners is a fraction of about 2,000 U.S. restaurant owners, that's largely unchanged.
There's also something else. So McDonald's had a Black CEO from 2012 to 2015, but Black leaders have left since then. Two Black executives even sued the company this year for racial discrimination. What did they allege?
That there's systemic discrimination, a culture of discrimination. I mean, even as McDonald's has its first Black CEO, as you mentioned, from 2012 to 2015, other execs are alleging a purge of executives of color, a hostile work environment. You can passively aggressively push people out by unfairly grading their locations and marking down their franchise value. So the complaint is pointing out that the number of McDonald's black operators actually hit a high of 377 back in 1998. Now you have about half that.
Do you think McDonald's franchise model, the model itself, makes it harder to get ahead in the company overall?
I think, Marge, if you step from this, this is a brutal time for the restaurant industry overall. And in a corporation, in a conglomerate as sweeping and as large as McDonald's, the chances are going to favor franchisees that are already well capitalized, that already have locations that can bump out, for example, drive-through capacity, that could pivot to Uber Eats and other aspects in a time of disruption for the industry. So those, I think the plaintiffs in this case that are alleging they've already had their hands tied behind one hand tied behind their back, it's just harder to innovate. It's harder to move up. It's harder to make a dent as a mega franchisee who then is looked at as somebody who might be promoted within the ranks to become a C-level executive. I think there's a lot of validity to that.
That is Robin Farzad, host of Public Radio's Full Disclosure.
I'm often asked, is there one thing you wish you could cover more in this extraordinarily packed news cycle? And I say, yes, climate change. So here we go. A recent report concluded that a total of 28 trillion tons of ice, yeah, trillions, has disappeared from the Earth's surface since 1994, a finding that shocked even the researchers conducting the study in the UK. They analyzed satellite images of the planet's ice-covered surfaces, everything, glaciers, mountains, poles, the first study to look at ice melts from every region of the planet. Researcher Andrew Shepherd is the director of Leeds University's Center for Polar Observation and Modeling. He was integral to this study. Professor Shepherd, welcome.
Hello, thanks for having me on the program.
And could you just tell us first, this is catastrophic, what you discovered. When you first realized the totality of this, how much ice had melted, you know, your thoughts, and we are a family-friendly program, so choose your words carefully, but what did you think?
Well, it was really quite a surprise to see how much ice has been lost when we looked everywhere. My team have looked at different parts of Earth's cryosphere on different occasions in the past. We tend to specialize in Antarctica and sometimes in Greenland. But when we added everything up together, we saw similar amounts of ice being lost in every corner of the planet, actually. And so that multiplied up what we'd been looking at from Antarctica alone, for instance, to a number that was much, much bigger and really quite worrying.
Yeah. Can you put it into some sort of, so that we can picture it, what 23 trillion tons of ice would look like?
Well, it's a huge number, and it's really hard for people to get their head around what that actually means. The reason we report the actual tonnage is so people can remember the simple amount that's being lost today. It's about a trillion tons each year, and so that's an easy number that people can remember. It might be hard for them to visualize what it actually means, but if you spread all of that ice on the UK, for instance, where I live, it would be 100 metres thick, 330-odd feet, right? I mean, that's a thick layer of ice, and the UK is not a small country. In the past, when we've looked at ice loss from Antarctica and Greenland, we've converted it straight into sea level rise because that's where the water ends up when it melts from above ground. But our study looks at the two different types of ice on Earth, the ice that's on the ground that we can see when we go to mountain ranges, for instance, but also the ice that's floating in the sea. And that doesn't convert straight into sea level rise because it's already part of the ocean. But it's just as important to Earth because it keeps us cooler than we otherwise would be.
Well, and let's talk about why, but start with the sea level rise. This ice that's normally above land and is melting into the sea and causing it to rise. You say that every centimeter of sea rise, that's about a third of an inch, means a million people will be displaced.
Yeah, we've tended to think about sea level rise being a problem for low-lying islands in the middle of the Pacific Ocean. And it's somewhat of a convenient displacement tactic because it makes people think they may not be affected. But it's become increasingly apparent that the bigger threat to our lifestyles and also livelihoods is coastal flooding when we have intense storms which superimpose themselves upon the mean sea level. And today, a coastal storm might only affect a city around the world once every 50 years or so. But if you press up sea level on average by even 50 centimetres, which is what we expect over the coming decades, the frequency of coastal flooding just goes up really, really quickly. And we expect an extra million people to be flooded once per year with every centimetre of sea level rise.
We already have many cities in the United States that have sunny day flooding, you know, water that's coming up through manholes. It has nothing to do with a storm. We know there's a whole town in Louisiana that's got to be moved. They're going to be climate change refugees because of coastal flooding there. So you're saying it's going to dramatically increase. That's one impact of the melting ice. The other you alluded to, this idea that these sheets of ice, whether they're out in the water, so they're already part of the sea and they may not cause the sea to rise, or whether they're on the land, they are white and they're reflective. And when they melt, what does that mean for air temperature?
Well, it only means one thing. It means that there's more blue on the planet because that was otherwise frozen and now it's ocean. It absorbs more heat and the planet warms up more quickly. That's the first simple positive feedback that people learned about when we first started studying climate change, was that if you retreat the sea ice, particularly in the Arctic Ocean, but also now in the Southern Ocean, so you just bring forward in time the sea level rise that we thought might be 50 or 100 years away, it's going to happen sooner because the floating ice is melting too.
Yeah. The report pretty much fulfills the worst case scenario that was predicted 30 years ago by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. That's the IPCC. What is your sense of, you know, people didn't believe it then, many didn't, and now you're presenting this in the middle of a pandemic and in some parts of the world, including the U.S., a moment of huge racial reckoning, economic collapse in several places because of the pandemic. What are the chances of your getting anyone's attention?
I think that people are concerned. Certainly for the past 3 months or so, our attentions have been elsewhere. But we've also been fortunate enough to learn in the past few months that we can live without many of the, I guess you might call them, luxuries that we used to believe we depended upon and that our economies depended upon. Transport, everybody flooding into cities every day to work in offices, and the consequences associated with that upon air pollution. We've learned through this natural experiment that the world doesn't end when we change our lifestyles, and we can continue and be prosperous. And so it's been a little bit of a fortunate experiment because people can't say now that we can't adapt to climate change. And then the next question is, what are the costs of doing nothing? And we now realise that economies can be rebalanced to deal with emergencies. We've done that in most countries in the world. We've found cash where people believed it didn't exist. And we could do the same for climate change. And ultimately, it won't be a luxury decision that we can afford to do because we feel worthy about it. It's a simple economic cost. We can't continue to allow coastal cities to be flooded and people to bear the cost.
It strikes me, though, you're not just fighting a pandemic, you're fighting, at least in some pockets, science denial during the pandemic, science denial about climate change. And yet you've got these facts. The researchers from the Alfred Wegener Institute for Polar and Marine Research published a report just a few days before your study revealing that 532 billion tons of ice melted in Greenland in 2019. That's 223 billion tons in the month of July alone. You know, Greenland has the world's second largest ice sheet. We were in Iceland, and we stood on this huge plain, several football fields long, looking up at a glacier we were going to climb, and learning that that glacier used to be where we were. It had receded several football fields. How long do you think we have?
Well, it's never too late to take action. For sure, we've already bought into a certain amount of sea level rise because we're not going to cool the planet back down again. I think that's unrealistic. But we're definitely able to slow down the rate with which the planet continues to warm. And the real challenge is making sure that the speed with which the melting occurs isn't too fast for us to be able to adapt and change our lifestyles around coastal areas. You pointed out about Greenland. There's been a couple of years prior to 2019 where Greenland was losing far less ice than it had been doing for the 10 years prior to that. And of course, people said, oh, this is all reversed. Well, it hadn't reversed. 2019 became the record melt year for Greenland ever. But even in those two relatively mild years, Greenland lost more than 100 billion tons of ice per year. And that's a very large number for Greenland alone. It's a new normal. We're living in a time when ice is melting everywhere on the planet. And now we've got 20 or 30 solid years of satellite measurements. It's really impossible for people to deny that that's happening. You might wish to argue, should I say, that the reason it's happening isn't because of anthropogenic or man-made climate warming, but the consequences are going to affect us irrespective of what the origin of these changes is. It is in fact true anyway that the only thing that can cause ice melting on this scale is global warming.
Andy Shepherd, director of Leeds University's Center for Polar Observation and Modeling. He also participated in the joint study that found that 28 trillion tons of ice has melted around the globe in the last three decades. Professor, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Residents of many communities in Louisiana are expected to be without power for weeks after Hurricane Laura caused severe damage to the power grid. The devastation comes as New Orleans marks the 15th anniversary of Hurricane Katrina. More than 1,500 people died in that storm, and most lived in or around New Orleans. Hundreds of thousands left the city, many have never returned, and it's only now, a decade and a half later, that people are noticing another loss to the city, its unique dialect. Patrick Cox reports.
Tourists love New Orleans because it's different.
Oh, yeah.
There's Mardi Gras. There are those uplifting funeral marches. And there's the way New Orleanians speak. It's a selling point for the tourist board.
Where you from, Yerm? But the kind of accent I have is, though, Creole.
Creole, he said. Creole can mean a lot of things. In New Orleans, it means someone of mixed race, usually with a combination of African, French, and Spanish heritage, whose ancestors likely came from the Caribbean. Many were freed slaves who settled in New Orleans. Over time, they developed a singular dialect and culture, sometimes, as with Zydeco music, mixing Creole and Cajun traditions.
I do feel that Creoles are a dying breed.
This is Chida Manuel, who's in her 60s and self-identifies as Creole.
They say every generation you lose something. I think we've lost a whole lot more.
Katrina, she says, was the turning point. People's homes were damaged, many destroyed. Dozens of Manuel's friends and neighbors were forced to leave the city, some never to return. And in the years after Katrina, others have moved to the city. White people mainly, Manuel says. People who claim to love Creole culture and the way of speaking, but they don't really, she says.
Then they want to tell us how to pronounce the names of our streets, which is an absolute no-no.
New Orleans' street name pronunciation is unique, as in
Calliope, Malpamine, Burgundy. You could be in a grocery store and they'll try and correct you. I don't like them. I wish they would just go back.
Arguments over street names may not seem like a big deal, but in New Orleans, they are. The longtime residents really set down roots.
People were born here, they lived here, they stayed in their neighborhood in New Orleans.
Katie Carmichael is a sociolinguist, born in New Orleans. Her family moved away, but she returned for college.
And I did my undergrad and my master's here, smack dab in the middle, Hurricane Katrina.
Carmichael was studying New Orleans dialects, which hadn't changed a lot in the years before Katrina because people stuck so close to home.
It was very typical to have a double, which is a house with two front doors and two apartments on either side where your mama was on one side and you were on the other side. How's your mama and dem is a common greeting here. Then you have Hurricane Katrina, and for the first time, everybody was displaced for at least a month.
We don't have transportation. I mean, we live in paycheck to paycheck. I mean, it ain't like we could just able to get up and just leave.
But many did leave. And to this day, there are large populations of the Katrina displaced in cities like Houston and Atlanta.
The biggest demographic difference pre and post-Katrina is the African-American population.
With this almost overnight population shift, Katie Carmichael started noticing linguistic changes too. Those newcomers who Chida Manuel disliked so much, they didn't speak the same way. And it wasn't just mispronouncing the street names. Everyone, locals and newcomers, were laying claim to certain archetypal New Orleans expressions.
Making groceries, one of those iconic linguistic phrases here, where yet, these phrases that the newcomers want to borrow and want to use, and there's this sort of rejection of that from the longstanding locals, even as in some cases the locals have already moved away from these features. There's this re-embracing of these things that they think are their property as New Orleanians.
This was already happening, but at a much slower pace. Katrina turbocharged the process of migration and gentrification. Carmichael, who's now at Virginia Tech, is documenting all this with a colleague. Their study is on hold right now because of the pandemic, but based on the research so far, they have some ideas about how Katrina is affecting the New Orleans dialect.
So one potential outcome is there's a growing linguistic divide within the city of New Orleans between the newcomers and the longstanding population. Another possibility is that these newcomers would assimilate to the local patterns. And then if they're here long enough, they have the next generation of kids. And those kids are truly New Orleanians. They're from here. And still a third possibility, which seems like perhaps the most likely right now, is that the newcomer influx will sort of drown out a lot of the things that made New Orleans linguistically distinct.
It's not an outcome that anyone wants, Carmichael says. It just seems to be happening. Different types of speech, just like different species of plants and animals, can be threatened by big weather events and mass migration. For Here and Now, I'm Patrick Cox.
And dialects are so interesting. Robin, I don't hear your New York dialect. I've gone away with my Detroit dialect.
Well, my mom was from upstate, but I can still go to the mall to die for.
Yeah, that's right. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now.